Good evening, Dr. Dang. We're Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. 21 March 2024. That makes it officially spring. So, yahoo! We are on Biochemical Mosaic number 3. Topic is inflammasomes. Now, that's very exciting. And it will last longer than the season, I'm sure. What season? Season of spring. So, let us begin where we left off. Now, you will recollect we were talking about the autoimmune cholangitis, and we were discussing it as an induced disease that could be performed on mice using that gram-negative Novosphingobium aromatisiborans bacteria. And I told you that there was an association with a protein called Gal-3. So we're going to start talking about Gal-3, and then that's going to link back up to the inflammasome. And then we'll be able to elaborate more on that platform and the association it has with both autophagy, which we covered last time, and indeed the inflammation that can cause chronic autoimmune disease, such as in obesity. So, galectin-3 is involved in multiple inflammatory responses, including even gut commensal bacteria. And this ultimately can actually lead to primary biliary cholangitis in humans, which, of course, is a form of cholestatic liver disease, right? So that's how we got to this point, this clinical aspect. So galectin-3. Now, remember that the NLRP3 proteins regulate the immune response. They're required for the initiation of it. And that response is to any kind of tissue injury, any kind of xenobiotic toxin, or indeed some kind of pathogenic microorganism infection. Okay. So these NLRP3 proteins engage multiple components of the innate and then ultimately the acquired immune systems. This NLR protein, cryopyrin, actually specifically acts as a receptor recognizing bacterial cell wall components. Now, once activated, multiple groups of the cryopyrin protein in the NLRP3 complex will auto-assemble themselves along with other proteins, and ultimately that will generate the inflammasome. And the inflammasome has to be completely structured for there to be a full onset, ensemble process of inflammation, post-induction. Okay? So I think that summarizes it, where we're at, where we kind of were last time. Now, what is galectin? Well, galectin has multiple isoforms, as most proteins do. Here we're talking about Gal-3. That's a member of the beta-galactoside binding protein. So it binds to that carbohydrate. It is basically a lectin, and there is a small amino terminal domain, a collagen-like domain called Col-D, and a carbohydrate recognition domain called CRD. And that CRD domain on Gal-3 has significant homology to CRDs on many other members of these beta-galactoside binding proteins. So on the cell surface, galectin-3 will interact with multiple glycans, particularly those carrying an N-acetolactosamine residue. Now, those are found as lysosomal-associated membrane proteins. So apart from the carbohydrate component, galectin-3 also interacts with the non-glycosylated protein component, such as certain domains that are histidine-rich. Also, proteins generally that have a sequence homology similar to elastin. So most of all those interactions with other molecules, including polypeptides, are actually attributed to its CRD. Now that's, remember, that's carbohydrate recognition domain. Okay. And other domains like the ColD also play perhaps regulatory roles, making that binding even to non-carbohydrate amino acid domain moieties. So galectin-3 is a cytosolic polypeptide, but it can be externalized. Most cells can actually externalize it, even though there isn't a signal peptide that would process that event. So it seems like galectin-3 uses secretory vesicles, and therefore it can be found sequestered therein. And of course, secretory vesicles are rich in membrane domains, and it appears that the N-terminal domain of lectin is involved in localization to those vesicles. Okay. Now, the vesicles itself are going to have a membrane lipid raft component. What does that mean? Compositionally, ceramide and cholesterol will be higher than most other membrane domains. Okay. So galectin-3 also, though, interacts with not just the cholesterol component, not just with ceramide, which is sphingolipid, but with other phospholipids. So galectin-3 interacts with the transverse component of the lipid bilayer. Okay. And this has been studied in unilamellar vesicles, or LUVs, L-U-Vs. Do you love that acronym? Now, this interaction between GAL3 and LUVs, unilamellar vesicles, seems to be energy independent. And also, there are no cofactors. So what does that suggest? It means that this might have something to do with the exocytosis of galectin-3 in living cells. In fact, at neutral pH, galectin-3 itself will have a positive charge density, specifically on that carbohydrate domain, that CRD. That may allow for, at the protein electrostatic level, to interact with anionic phospholipids. But when it interacts with zwitterionic phospholipids and even cholesterol, that's probably a hydrophobic interaction, of course, because the zwitterionic would be basically neutral, right? And remember, some lipids can be anionic and then zwitterionic and then switch back to anionic depending on pH change. And that has to do with the mobility of the lipid within the membrane. We were covering this when we were talking about plasmalogens, as you recall. Okay. Now, the interaction of GAL3 with a 8-anilino-1 naphthalene sulfonic acid labeled liposome will occur in the hydrophobic region of the lipid bilayer. So that's how that was first determined. And that means that there's a good thermodynamic free energy equation that will provide the correct chemistry to insert into that bilayer, right? So in fact, galectin-3 will organize and form dynamic complexes with membrane phospholipids in situ. So, barring the presence of glycans on the surface of those large unilamellar vesicles, galectin-3 will spontaneously diapedise, or basically penetrate, the lipid bilayer, and it can actually move right into the cytosol, okay, that protein can. In fact, exogenously added galectin-3 will enter, for example, breast carcinoma cells. And in fact, doing that mediates an internalization of beta-1 integrins. So that's a component of cell surface interaction driven by endocytic uptake of galectin-3. And it's all occurring in the caveolae lipid raft domain of those membranes. Remember, those caveolae are highly detergent resistant component domains of membranes that allow for trafficking of proteins and also vesicular trafficking containing proteins and sometimes nucleic acids, sometimes other lipids. And remember why those detergent resistant caveoli are detergent resistant, because they're high in sphingolipids. Detergents tend to function less in an integrative way to disrupt the membrane when there's higher levels of ceramide in particular. Okay, so remember that from our discussion of ceramide. That wasn't that long ago. It was like a month ago, I think. Right? So I'm giving you all this information because this is what you need to know. So let's go back to the NLRP3 inflammasome that's going to be associated with this GAL3 interaction, right? You have to consider that the inflammasome has to be primed and then activated. What do you think the primer is going to be? It's going to be a reception of a signal. In almost every case, because these are innate immune cells, what do innate immune cells have in common? They have TLRs, toll-like receptors. And they will sense those pathogen or danger-associated molecular patterns. Those are the PAMPs and DAMPs. And that will trigger the nuclear factor kappa light chain enhancer of activated B cells, also known as NF-kappa-B. That will induce NLRP3 and pro-interleukin-1 beta transcription. Okay. So that's all the initial priming phase. The activation will involve NLRP3 inflammasome assembly. Remember that include all those other proteins such as caspase 1, because you're going to need caspase 1 activation to do what? To mature interleukin 1 beta and mature interleukin 18. Remember those two proinflammatory cytokines need to be proteolytically matured via those convertases. Caspase 1 acts as a convertase there. Now, to make it more interesting, is mitochondria are involved in the NF-kappa-B activation. Okay? So the toll-like receptor engagement results in the interferon regulatory factor 1 dependent induction of cytidine monophosphate kinase 2. That's CMPK2. And of course, the interferon regulatory factor is IRF1. So those two acronyms you should have on your language skill set anyway, IRF1 and CMPK2, less so, but still very important in toll-like receptor mediated responses. All of this becomes rate limiting because that's associated with the mitochondrial nucleotide kinase cascade. That means it's also involved in the initiation of mitochondrial DNA replication. Yes. That's cytidine monophosphate kinase 2, because it's associated with the nucleotide, you see, is involved in mitochondrial DNA replication. Okay, so that's how it was named. So here we're talking about toll-like receptor engagement with it as well. Okay. So, moonlighting effects of many polypeptides, as you find out, right? Now, before mitochondrial DNA gets fully replicated, it is compacted into what are called nucleoids. And this newly synthesized mitochondrial DNA, when it's exposed to reactive oxygen, which often occurs because of the incomplete, you know what I'm going to say, reduction of molecular oxygen to H2O. So that will trigger within the mitochondrial membrane calcium influx and potassium efflux. And that was going to generate then that oxidized mitochondrial DNA. Remember, that gets released in the cytosol where it binds to the NLRP3 to trigger the inflammasome assembly. Okay? This is where these organelles get their real deep, authentic biochemical event ontology. You see? So when you say something like the mitochondria are involved, now I'm explaining to you specifically how it is. Because the production of this oxidized mitochondrial DNA. Because if it's exposure to reactive oxygen, calcium efflux, potassium efflux, and then binding of that oxymitochondrial DNA to the NLRP3, triggering the inflammasome assembly. Okay? So so we're almost to this point we were at the very beginning of this mosaic a couple of days ago. Another target, you'll remember now as soon as I say it, for cytosolic mitochondrial DNA is that DNA sensing enzyme, the cyclic GMP-AMP synthase, also known, remember, as cGAS. And that leads to the activation of the stimulator of interferon genes, that STING. So that's how I told you how we all started with the inflammasome, remember? cGAS STING. Now, even though NLRP3 shows a preference for a specific oxynucleotide, that would be 8-oxoguanine, 8-oxo-G, right? That kind of DNA. Any oxidized mitochondrial DNA that can be processed into smaller fragments that enters the cytosol from the mitochondria does trigger the NLRP3 inflammasome assembly and activation. Now, that's associated with STING phosphorylation. It's a kinase cascade going on. And that will all mediate subsequent interferon production by the non-apoptotic macrophages. Because macrophages, you know, can be apoptotic or non-apoptotic, right? In the regulation of the innate immune response, initial sensu stricto. Okay. Now, that same pathway that I just went through can also allow for the release of cell-free mitochondrial DNA. Now, that's well known to be a systemic inflammatory mediator that's found in the blood. Okay. So you probably have heard of that sometime or other. Now, primary biliary cirrhosis, PBC, is characterized by a T-cell mediated destruction of the bile duct epithelia. And of course, the bile duct epithelia line the small intrahepatic bile duct. Now, host targets of the activated T cells are the dihydrolipoamide acetyltransferase components of the dehydrogenases, particularly of the 2-oxoacid dehydrogenases. What's a well-known 2-oxoacid dehydrogenase? Pyruvate dehydrogenase, PDH, of course. See? Now, of course, PDH is a mitochondrial enzyme, remember? What is PDH generating in mitochondria? Acetyl-CoA. Right. Now, this bacterium, this N. aromatosivirans, seems to be able to link up with this whole inflammasome regulation. Okay? And that's why they use it in the mouse study, right, as an inducer. So that's why I wanted you to get this whole process of why it's done in the laboratory. Now, interestingly, there was a study done in Italy back in the 1990s that showed that many of the people that had been diagnosed with primary biliary cirrhosis were carrying antibodies to a protein called PDCE2, which is associated with these bacteria. That means that primary biliary cirrhosis can have as one of its etiologic sources of disease an infection by a bacterium such as Novosphingobium aromatosivirans. See how this plays back into the clinical induction of that disease, right? Because they found antibodies to it in when they looked at some 77 PBC patients. This was studied in Milan, Italy. All of them had antibodies to that bacterium. Okay, so that's interesting. So that's why they use it for these studies to induce the inflammasome. Again, bacterium, just for those of you who have bacteriology background, gram-negative, non-spore-forming rod. It supports or generates a single polar flagellum when it's motile. And it is an obligate aerobe. Also important to know. Okay. Now, unlike your typical gram-neg bacteria, it doesn't even have an lipopolysaccharide layer, but it has a glycosphingolipid, which is typically far more common in what kind of membranes? Mammalian membranes. Okay, so this is another interesting mimicry between this bacterium, this aerobic bacterium that you find in the soil, and the lipids you find in that bacterium, and the same lipids are associated, they're not identical, of course, totally different molecular species. I'm not going to tell you that. But they're similar, more similar than what you normally find in bacteria, free bacteria with this kind of genomic and phenotypic background I just gave to you. The lipids more common to mammals, which they're going to be infecting, versus other bacteriums. That's curious, right? Now, there is, of course, sphingans, and sphingans found in certain bacteria will easily colonize all eukaryotes, including plants, marine organisms, and humans. Okay, and those sphingans are these unusual glycosphingolipids you find in this bacteria. Okay, all right. Now, I want you to keep in mind that ceramide generated by the enzyme sphingomyelinase on sphingomyelin, which is a component of what? The myelin sheath of the axons, remember? That once you generate ceramide, that generates an inflammatory response in the CNS. Okay? So you get where there is a linkage back to that. I always like to bring back where there is something you need to remember, because that's the way you put together a knowledge base, right? By remembering multiple circuitry. And that's why I talk about not substance ontologies, but event ontologies. If you remember what this bacterium is doing relative to the induction of the inflammasome and this unusual glycolipid, which has a sphingosine base, and how sphingosines in general, when they generate or sphingolipids, when they're generating ceramide, is a pro-inflammatory sphingolipid, you start to see where these are associated molecular events triggering this inflammatory response. You see, that's why I'm doing this for you. All of this generating, again, the inflammasome. And then, of course, in the human system we're talking about, this is primarily going to be triggered through the TLR, and the TLR is going to be found in those innate immune cells. Okay. Epithelia as well, though. Now, the reason I bring up the immune cells is because that's what's going to trigger the full-blown immune inflammatory response, which will then bring in the T cells, right? You see? Because the acquired immune cells are then going to be triggered because of the production of chemokines. And also, what? Cytokines. Yeah. And growth factors. Now, one of the main inflammatory pathways leading to the development of most inflammatory diseases is going to be that activation of the inflammasome. Okay? So that's why many research programs looking at the inflammasome are trying to figure out ways target it, target some of its polypeptides, target its assembly, target its activation, or target its downstream sequelae, such as the production of IL-1 beta and IL-18. See? So one of the other ideas is, what about the interregulation of the inflammasome with autophagy? Because remember, autophagy can control the inflammasomal response. Remember that? Because the autophagy is going to then do what? It's going to be breaking down these macromolecular structures. Like what? Like the inflammasome. Okay? So it's, again, it's all at the level of logic. So if you remember what these events are, you have to memorize everything, because it will come to you as a complete criterion for a knowledge base, right? So that you really do understand how this infection plays a role in what it's doing, or if it's non-infectious, how you can get inflammasome activation, triggering mostly distal responses, but even some of the proximal responses related to the activation. Well, first the assembly and then the activation of the inflammasome. Okay. So the interregulation of inflammasomes and autophagy is, of course, an intracellular event. And what do we say about autophagy? It has to do with the breakdown of macromolecular structures such as proteins, membrane lipid domains, and nucleic acids, right? And organelles. Remember, autophagy is involved in the dissimulation of organelles. Mitophagy, peroxisomophagy. We've already talked about this, right? Even nuclear envelope sometimes degradation. Now, intracellular processes like having damaged proteins or organelles, or even like when there's an intracellular pathogen that's being torn apart, right, by the autophagolysosome, right? All of that can trigger autophagy. But when autophagy is not functioning correctly, what the cell goes to directly then is the inflammatory response. In fact, that has a lot to do with inflammatory bowel disease. That's right. So IBD has a lot to do with cell fate being corrupted and not going into an autophagic response, but rather going into an inflammatory response, leading to chronic IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, and all the terrible morbidity associated with that in the clinic. So I'm going to stop here. I think we've done enough introduction of more of the players of the inflammasome. I wanted to make sure to talk to you about galectin 3 because it's an important player. I wanted to let you know about the whole bacterial association with inflammasomes. You didn't think that was just some esoteric lab using this unusual bacterium to induce that in mice. No, the whole concept was basically initially from the clinical isolates and finding antibody to that bacterium, and then that being associated with cholangitis. Right, see? All right. Dr. Dan Guerra from Authentic Biochemistry Podcast on this relatively wonderful Thursday evening on the 21st of March, 2024, saying bye for now.